Hi everyone and welcome to Lyrics of the Life. I'm your host Adam Hampton and today I have for you a very special interview with Dr. Matt Fink, known best for his role as the keyboard and synthesizer player in the Doctor's outfit for Prince and the Revolution. Dr. Fink was a key member of Prince's band for over 10 years and today he shares with us some of his incredible stories of his time with Prince and the Revolution, what it was like growing up in Minneapolis, what life was like after Prince and the Revolution, and where he is today. It was a privilege to speak with Dr. Fink, and I hope you enjoy this interview. So, hello and welcome to Lyrics of Their Life. Today, we're joined by a very special guest, Dr. Matt Fink. Matt, thank you so much for joining us today. And I suppose we'll get straight into it and start from the very beginning.
Yeah. Sure, go right ahead.
You were born and raised in Minneapolis, Minnesota in the US in 1958. Could you describe for our listeners that may not be familiar with the area what it was like growing up there?
Well, Minneapolis is, and St. Paul, which they call it the Twin Cities because they're right next to each other. But Minneapolis and St. Paul is really slap dab in the middle of the North American continent. And it's not really an extremely populous area, you know, yep. Minneapolis, St. Paul. When I was a kid growing up, I think Minneapolis had maybe a total of 450,000 people living in the actual city. And then you had the surrounding suburbs, you know, the suburb I lived in, which was one of the first suburbs they built, you know, around the World War II area when they were expanding out into those areas away from the city. The population there peaked at about 50,000, and now I think it's sitting more like around 38,000 or 40, you know, because people have moved out further out in, you know, outer suburbs. I'm in an outer suburb, about half hour south of Minneapolis. Yeah. And when I lived in St. Louis Park, that was only like a 9-10 minute drive from downtown. So it's a whole really close in to the city. Yeah. But it's a very nice place to be because, first of all, the state of Minnesota has great, you know, tons of lakes, great water sports, you know, fishing, you name it. You know, the state name is the land of 10,000 lakes because of all the glacier lakes that we have here from when the glaciers covered North America and what's left over now. And but, you know, you have four seasons. And like I was just telling you a moment ago before we started, we're in the middle of a really bad cold snap.
Yeah.
It's going to go about 2 weeks long. Fortunately, it's going to end tomorrow. At least we'll be still be a little bit below zero at night, but it's going to be in the 30s Fahrenheit by the weekend. So I'm excited to get back to nicer weather again because I haven't been able to get out and do my hiking that I like to do every day. It's nice out. I get out. Well, during the pandemic, it's the only way to stay sane is to get out there, exercise, and get your endorphins going. Now, from what I understand, is Australia, of course, and New Zealand are doing pretty well with the pandemic now.
Whereas they're doing pretty well, actually. Yeah, they're keeping pretty well on top of it. Yeah. So
Where here we aren't quite there, but things are declining at the moment because people finally are listening to our leaders of the country and the states to stay masked up and stay socially distanced and do all things. Me personally, being who I am, I had a mask on literally the first day they declared a pandemic. I went out shopping with a mask on and people were looking at me like, what is up with this guy? And I said, hey, I used to wear masks when I was, you know, playing for Prince. So there it is. Pretty funny stuff.
Was there any sort of like hobbies you're into growing up, like sports or anything?
As long as we're talking about winter, I was way into winter sports. I played hockey. I became a really good skier.
Yeah,
in fact, to the level of where I actually had a job lined up to be a ski instructor when I was 18. But then I ended up going into a band that was touring around my 5-state area here that age. Just I was a senior in high school at the time. So I decided to take the live music gig instead of taking the ski instructor's gig. But yeah, I used to be on the ski team and race ski, you know, and I got into some trick skiing and going over jumps and stuff like that. It was a lot of fun. I also was into hockey. I mentioned cross country skiing. I never really did much ice fishing. That's something I didn't get into very much, but ice fishing is a big thing here. I did a little bit of snowmobiling, but I never owned one. I had friends who had snowmobiles. I'd get out on the snowmobile occasionally like that. And other than that, you know, other than typical winter sports, my other hobbies were, you know, I like, now that I'm older, you know, I like gardening and keeping up with all the best, you know, movies and TV shows, stuff like that, and music and all the artists that are out there. I'm always trying to keep up with what's popular. And
any current artists that you're into now? Or
yeah, you know, I really like Dua Lipa right now.
Yeah,
I like her. I of course I like all the really, you know, good rap artists out there, like Travis Scott, and you know, a guy named Saint John. I really like right now. I could go on and on. There's so many great sounding people right now that are happening in the mainstream music world. It's just and I love all the great independents that I hear out there, you know, people that are newer. There's so much talent that I can't keep up with it. It's impossible. I'd like to keep up with it, but I just can't do it. But anyway, I always take recommendations from my two sons, who are always up on the latest stuff, including my oldest son, who's a music producer in his own right these days, an artist as well.
Awesome. Do you remember the first time you ever heard a song that sort of made you think, this is what I want to get into, sort of thing? Or
definitely, pretty much the entire, you know, what was called the British Invasion of 1963, 64, that era, you know, when the Rolling Stones and the Beatles were coming along, and the Who and all those groups from over there. They, you know, when I was 6 years old, the Beatles debuted on Ed Sullivan show, and I saw that live when it happened, and that really influenced me immediately, even at that young of an age. And by the time I was 12, when they released the Sgt. Pepper album, I was such a big fan that I literally went to the store and purchased it the day it was released and put it on the turntable that evening, listened to it. And at the age of nine is when it came out. I was 9 years old, and I put that on. And when I heard what was coming out of it compared to what they'd done earlier, I was astounded. I didn't understand it. I was a bit young to fully intellectually, you know, process what they were doing. And emotionally, it, you know, like the song A Day in the Life, you know, when that came on, I was just like, it frightened me almost. It was scary. You know, it had a scary feel to it. It was especially that whole cacophony of orchestral nightmare music that takes place twice during the song. Anyway, highly influenced by the Beatles. And I had I was very fortunate in November of 2019 to be a counselor for what's called the Rock and Roll Fantasy Camp. It's been going on for like, I don't know, 17 years. This is my first opportunity to be involved. Someone I knew there asked me if I wanted to come on board as a counselor and do their Beatles camp. Of course, yes, I immediately said, yes, I'd love to do the Beatles camp. And we performed the Sgt. Pepper album.
Oh, cool. Yeah.
With members of Cheap Trick coming up and
off
the stage with all the different, we had all these different groups with different, you know, celebrity counselors running their bands and performing songs in the final day. But the, you know, the, you're there for a week, and then on the weekend, on Saturday and Sunday, you perform at two different venues, and then it culminates in that Sunday night gig where we did Sgt. Pepper. And it was incredible. First of all, we each group went up and played like a couple of their songs that they worked up that were just non Sgt. Pepper songs, and then and then the entire big show happened, and we even had a full orchestra up there with us doing songs like Within You, Without You, and you know, any other songs that needed live strings and horns and stuff like that. It was just incredible.
Awesome. Yeah. So you were part of a band in your teen years, or?
Oh yeah. Yeah, yeah. Definitely. I mean, my first group came to be when I was 12 and a half years old.
Yeah.
And we did some parties, you know, in those days, early parties. And then we were in junior high at that time, you know, so we started performing at other schools in the area. We would contact, you know, the head people at those schools and say, hey, we're available to play your school dance if you want. And And they did. They hired us. It was really, really a lot of fun. So that nucleus of musicians, we stayed together all the way through our senior year in high school. And then, as I mentioned before, when I auditioned for this other group that was not my current band, I wanted to move on because some of the other band members were going to go off to college right away. I wasn't planning on it. And so I was looking for another job. And then I was touring with that group for a little over a year, year and a half. And then I joined another band and did the same thing till I was about, almost 21, not quite 21 years old. Mm. And that's when I auditioned for Prince.
Yeah.
In the fall of 1978, when I was still 20 years old. And then I turned 21 in February, a couple months later. But
do you remember what it was like when you first went into that audition with Prince?
Very vividly remember that, actually. Yeah. Still. Yeah, it's you're nervous, of course, because you're meeting this guy that's like, he and I were the same age at that time. I mean, we were born the same year, and yet he was definitely ahead of me in the music business for where I was at. I was just, auditioning for this guy who's like signed to a major label at the age of 19.
Yeah.
He was 20 when I met him, but it was a little bit nerve wracking because you don't know how it's going to go or how he's going to be. So yeah, I was nervous, but he made me feel at ease pretty quickly. And he played a little joke on me and said, so did you learn this one song on the album called So Blue? And I said, no, I didn't work on that one. I only worked on the single and a couple other ones I was told to work on. And he goes, well, don't worry about it. There's no keyboards on it anyway.
Yeah. So, yeah, I heard he had like a great sense of humor, but often was pretty quiet.
Yeah, but no, well, he wasn't quiet around us. He just was he wanted to be the man of mystery.
Yeah.
For the fans, because actually when you stay silent and don't do interviews and you do all that, it just creates the mystique around you, I think. And he knew that, used that as a technique to gain notoriety.
In the American Bandstand interview, with Dick Clark, I was going to ask you about that one. A lot of people say he was just feeling awkward or because he was on TV in front of so many people. But then I've heard stories where Dick Clark said something that sort of peed him off. Do you know what Prince was sort of trying to get at there? Or
no, Prince was wanting to obviously just create hype about himself.
Yeah,
and the way to do that was to kind of come off like how he did. A,
yeah.
B, it came off worse than it should have though, because he had a cold at the time, and he had been taking antihistamines to keep his nose from running on stage and everything else. And he fortunately didn't have to sing because that performance is always done via lip sync, tracks for Bandstand. So at the end of dancing his butt off, he had to do this interview and he was so dried out from the antihistamines because they just dry everything out, Benadryl or whatever's in that stuff. And so he was having a hard time talking. He was out of breath and really dry. So his whole intent was to mess with Dick.
Yeah.
On purpose.
Yeah.
But it didn't come off quite right. It made him look a little more like what's with this guy? That's a little odd.
Yeah.
So we didn't know, but as band members, we didn't know he was going to do that.
I think that's what made him so great too. That sort of mystique around him, like how he's often quiet in interviews and it worked.
It was really done as a tactic to draw more attention.
Yeah. Awesome. So I've read that around age 7, you started playing piano, like classical and jazz piano.
Yeah.
As you were the keyboard and synthesizer player for Prince and the Revolution, did you always know that's the type of instrument you wanted to play? Or was there any others like drums or singing or anything like that?
Yeah, when I was a kid growing up, I wanted to play drums too.
Yeah.
And I did have a drum set at one time, but then I didn't pursue it seriously. I really focused on the piano and stuff, keyboards, because that was where my heart was. And that's what I started out on. But I've become a decent, if you want to call it, drum programmer, for songs, for production work. I'm decent at that. I don't really play live drums much at all anymore, but that's what I do. I don't play much guitar either. I tried a little bit into it, I dabbled in it a little bit. I just love keyboards and that's it.
Did you have any did you come from a musical family or have any friends growing up that sort of got you into it or sort of nurtured your love for music?
Yeah, my parents were definitely instrumental in that because they're the ones who asked me to, if I was interested in taking piano. My older brother was already studying it when I was, little. He was about three grades ahead of me, 3 years. But both of my parents were actors and had degrees in theater from the University of Minnesota. So they were, and my mom played piano growing up. My father played a little bit of piano growing up, but he didn't have formal training, but he wanted formal training. But when he was a kid growing up, he had to live through the Depression era and all that, and then fight in World War II and all that stuff, So his family couldn't really afford to give him piano lessons growing up, but he really wanted to. So that's why he provided that for my brother and I, that opportunity. It certainly wasn't forced on us, I'll tell you that. But they said, here, try this. They were just nurturing, nurturing, which really is good, and not forcing me to practice all the time and all, it was none of that. No heavy disciplinary stuff going on. But my brother became a very proficient classical pianist and then was in a band also ahead of me when he was in junior high. He was in that for a few years through his ninth grade. But then he didn't pursue it professionally. He didn't care for it enough to do that. He wanted to do other things. And then I inherited his equipment in that first band I was telling you about.
Yep.
And I got into it in a big way because I was inspired to. And I have to credit my parents 100% for bringing me into it. And then, of course, the first drummer I worked with who lived down the street, who was in that first band, he and I were jamming and playing. As soon as he moved into the neighborhood and I discovered he had a little drum set, that was it. So from the time we were eight until we formed that first band, we were jamming in the basement.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
Do you remember what it was like when you first met the Revolution band members, like Bobby Z and Gail Chapman, Des Dickerson?
Well, so the thing is about Bobby is that I already knew Bobby. In fact, it was because of Bobby that I was able to get into the group, actually, to get the audition. I met him the first time when I was really young. I think I was around six or seven, too, at that time. And that was because my mother and his mother and my father and his father were both involved in fundraising events for a local hospital here in Minneapolis. They would do, they did a few of them, when we were kids growing up. One year, my father and his father were the actual hosts, MCs of the event. And my mom and Bobby's mother did a skit with another lady where they did a comedy skit and things like that, to raise money. So that's when I first met Bobby. I would see him occasionally over time because our parents were not the closest friends, but they were acquaintances and did those events and stuff. So we'd see them occasionally. And then Bobby also grew up in the same suburb that I did in Minneapolis. We weren't neighbors because he was on the opposite side of that suburb from where I was. And so when I was playing in this one group at the time, I think it was 18 or 19, Bobby brought me Prince's demo tape to hear when I was at a show. Doing a show that night, a gig at a club. And he took me out to the car to listen to the cassette of the Prince's demo. And I said, wow, this is great. Who's the band?
Yeah.
And he says, it's not a band. And I go, what do you mean it's not a band? He goes, this one guy in the studio writing and singing and producing all the music himself.
Yeah.
I go, you gotta be kidding me. He goes, yeah. And he's the same age as you. And I said, even more intriguing. So, basically I just said to him at that moment, I said, well, this is really interesting. What's going to happen? He goes, well, we're trying to get him a record deal. I work as an intern for his manager right now.
Yeah.
And I said, okay, well, let me know how it progresses. So about a year later, that's when I knew he'd gotten signed to Warner Brothers. And that's when I pursued getting an audition through Bobby and Bobby's manager.
Brandon. Awesome. Do you remember what your first gig was like? I heard that on one of your first gigs, there was like a chaotic situation where a snowstorm was blowing through and noises were coming through like CB radio and stuff like that.
Oh, well, yeah, sure. The very first showcase gig in Minneapolis that we did for the Warner Brothers people, they flew in from LA, and they flew in early January or mid-January. Same issue we're having right now with below zero temperatures. Yeah. They're not used to it. They're coming in from LA. I don't believe there was a snowstorm. It was just a bad cold snap. So they came in, and there were two shows, one night and one the following night. And I think they came to the second one. I can't remember for sure if it was the first or second one. But our guitarist, Des Dickerson, had a wireless guitar system that he had just purchased recently at that time. And it was not the greatest system, and it was picking up police radios and stuff while we were doing the show. So we had to stop the show and get his thing taken apart and taken away so he could just have a cable for his guitar. So it was about a 10-minute lull in the action in the middle of a show, and Prince had to try to talk to the audience and say, hey, we're having some technical difficulties. Please hang tight.
Yeah.
How y'all doing? You know. So that's what happened there.
Yeah, fair enough. How did the idea for the doctor's outfit come about?
Yeah, that story is interesting too. You know, in the beginning of it all, Prince was trying to have every band member figure out an image for themselves, you know?
Yeah.
And he said, I want you to be the quirky guy. Quirky. I go, well, what does that mean? He goes, well, you're funny, you know, you're outgoing. Just want you to be like the sort of a weird guy.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. So my first, you know, I tried some different looks in the beginning, and when we shot early videos for the, first album and second album, I think it was, and nothing was quite clicking with him. And then when we did the American Bandstand show, that's when I came up with the guy in the black and white striped jail suit.
Yeah.
So he liked that look, you know, liked that fact. And it didn't last long though, because when we went on tour for the first time opening for a major label act, which would happen to be Rick James.
Yeah.
He was coming out on stage in a jail suit on one song, and the title was Busting Out of L7. And so we're about three shows into the tour, and this tour is going to last for, this is going to be like a 5.5 month tour. So out on the road, maybe almost 6 months. And I said, oh boy. And he goes, you're going to have to change your image.
Yeah.
Because the headliner's wearing your suit.
Yeah.
On a song. And I go, oh shoot. So he said, What were some other ideas you may have had before you settled on the jailer outfit? And I said, how about a guy in a surgeon's outfit, a doctor?
Yeah.
That was another thought I had before. I said, a reason I didn't go with the doctor suit is because I thought the black and white stripes went really cool with keyboards, with the black and white keyboards. Said, yeah, well, that makes sense. Yeah, it's kind of cool. Because when you're shooting videos and you're getting angles and stuff, and I'm standing there and then playing, you know, and you got the look, it's kind of interesting. Now, no one was really doing that yet, as far as I know. So he said, okay, the doctor thing, I like that. Okay, so we're going to send someone out to get you doctor everything. So they got me all the scrub suits. They got me all the accessories that doctors need.
Stethoscope. You know, and
everything.
Yeah.
All of it. Including even, I even had like a headband with a mirror on it, reflector mirror, and a surgeon's cap and the mask and the whole thing. And then, of course, when you see me on the Dirty Mind album sleeve, you know, I'm fully covered like some, you know, funny horror movie doctor. So that was the whole objective, is to like, oh, more mystery. Who's that guy?
Yeah. Yeah. So one thing that I thought was amazing with how Prince and his band represent a range of races, religions, genders, and sexualities, which came to be known at the time as the Rainbow Band to some. Did it feel like you were helping break down stereotypes?
Yeah, absolutely. And we are definitely trying to have a multi-racial, multi-gender group. That was Prince's vision, but it was also all of our vision. We really like the fact that he, or that he was making it that way, that he was making the group more like a Fleetwood Mac model.
Yeah.
You know, so, and especially at that, in that time, things were still very segregated in the music industry. And
yeah.
In particular, yeah. In Minneapolis, your mainstream rock and roll radio stations, top 40, didn't really play much funk or, you know, black people's music. I mean, yeah, you heard the Supremes probably, there's probably some Motown going and all that stuff, but not enough. There wasn't enough. It was just, and then in Minneapolis, you only had like one black radio station, and it was of course not a very powerful radio station. It was called it still exists now, KMOJ, but it was segregated and it was just, you know, awful.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Wrong. Just wrong.
Yeah.
But that's changed. Thankfully it's changed, even though our country is still in the throes of scared white people who are worried that, you know, the brown peoples of the world are going to take over America, which is absurd.
It was well documented that Prince was highly controversial, especially in his earlier days, as he dressed quite flamboyant and his lyrics were quite raunchy. I understand Gail Chapman left the band due to religious beliefs clashing with this material. How did the rest of the band feel about this sort of controversial style?
Well, for me personally, I grew up in a very liberal-minded household, politically very, very liberal, open to the arts. You know, I mean, my parents, you know, they were taking me to see the play Hair when I was 10 years old, which had nudity in it. You know, so one time I was on a business trip with my father and my mom and my brother to Chicago, and they took us to see Broadway plays. So we saw a few while we were there, and one happened to be Hair in particular. And, you know, it was a hippie, long-haired hippie play, musical.
Mm.
So, yeah, I had no problem with sexuality and the stuff that Prince was doing and the messages he was putting out there. Again, Gail Chapman, yeah, maybe didn't appreciate it as much.
In November 1980, Prince released the song Dirty Mind. What was it like becoming the first member of Prince's band to be credited on a track, especially when he had previously recorded all the instruments himself?
I was very excited about that, obviously. I mean, I wanted to collaborate with him as much as possible, but it just wasn't, because he just had his vision. And he did. It was not easy to you know, get stuff through him that he would use. So I was happy that he grabbed something that I came up with musically. He wrote the lyrics and melody. But
in 1981, Prince and the Revolution supported the Rolling Stones on the Tattoo You tour. The story goes that Prince decided to perform the Jack You Off song in front of a row of bikers, which was met with a hostile response. What is your memory of that tour and the reception you received?
Well, it really wasn't a tour per se. There was only supposed to be I suppose it's a mini tour. We were supposed to play, I think, 4 or 5 shows in big stadiums, like dome stadiums and outdoor stadiums and stuff like that. And just because the crowd became so hostile, it was impossible to perform. I mean, they were throwing stuff at us, and Prince almost got hit in the head with a glass bottle, you know, missed him by mere, you know, who knows, you know, an eighth of an inch probably. So, and I got hit. I remember getting hit in the head with a crumpled up, you know, one of those Coca-Cola cups, you know, and it stung because they really threw it hard, you know, they crumpled it up into a ball and bam, you know, it gets you. So yeah, it was very disconcerting, disappointing. I was actually in shock that an audience would be that hostile.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I never really encountered anything like that before. Yeah. So I don't know if it was in reaction to a song like Jack You Off, like they were really pissed them off that they did that, that we did that song, or why, but it was very, it threw us off, really. It threw Prince off quite a bit. But he didn't care, because he knew, he said, look, those aren't our fans. That's a Rolling Stones crowd. So what? So we were introduced to those people. Not everybody's going to hate us. Oh, you had whatever those people that were haters. But later on, as we all know, he garnered a massive audience. So, you know, those kind of early missteps happen, and that's just how it goes, you know.
What was life like on the road for yourself?
Well, I enjoyed it, you know. Yeah. Of course, the early years, you know, it's the kind of thing where you're building. It's a building process. There's not a lot of money around yet. You've got tour support from the label in those days, which was nice. But you know, in those first few years, especially the first tours of, you know, like Showcase and Rick James and all that stuff, I was rooming with Bobby Z. We had to share a hotel. Eventually, we didn't have to do that anymore because we were able to sustain things better. So, but touring was always good. And then by the time we got to the Purple Rain tour, of course, that was just like, you know, first class all the way, no matter where we did or where we went, it was all good. You know, it was all very top-notch hotels and first-class seats on the planes. And we even chartered a plane for a while. So touring was always comfortable for me. I never had a problem with it.
Awesome. So what was it like starring in a blockbuster film like Purple Rain?
Very exciting because we're a bunch of young dudes from Minneapolis, not Hollywood.
Yep.
And, you know, we're growing up in a place that, you know, just extremely fortunate to have the opportunity to do what we did and not have to move to the West Coast or the East Coast where the, you know, or Nashville or anything. Although, because, you know, Warner Brothers is based in L.A., we were out there a lot, obviously. We, you know, Prince would bring us there, and sometimes I'd be there for a month at a time or more.
Yeah.
Doing stuff, you know, working with him. But for the most, rehearsing or shooting videos or whatever we had to do that had to be done in Los Angeles. But still, it really was a dream come true, really, when you think about it, for all of us, because, you know, that's what you're striving for. You're really striving to do that. But, you know, it really takes somebody like Prince with that drive and ambition and to lead something like that, to make it happen. He was so driven to do what he did, you know.
Yep.
He just never stopped working. It was amazing. I personally, I think if I had not met him, I don't think I would have gone on to the same kind of success without him. Because he was there, you know, doing the major bulk of the writing and the recording.
Yeah.
Without, I was just there as the support team,
yeah.
You know, and being a side man and all that, and fortunate enough and grateful enough to have some co-writes with him along the way.
Yeah.
But, he's a genius, you know, period, bar none.
With those songs you co-wrote with Prince, like 17 Days, Computer Blue, America and Dirty Mind, just to name a few. Which of those were your favorites to work on and why?
I think one of the favorites was Computer Blue, just because it was such a non-typical pop song.
Yeah.
You know, untypical, just not your average piece of work. You know, the arrangement, the way it went to the middle section, you know, instrumental part.
Yeah, yeah.
Which was, by the way, his father's melody.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
That's where that came from. So it was a collaboration between Prince, myself, Lisa and Wendy were involved in that song, and Prince's father. So it's just really an interesting piece of work and how it all came together, you know, the way he arranged it and his vision for it.
Yeah.
Really, really, really unique.
I love the instrumentals in that song. 17 Days is one of my personal favorites too, so yeah.
Yeah, I was fortunate to have him credit, you know, members of the Revolution for that, even though it's really mostly him.
Yeah.
To be honest.
Yeah.
But I mean, I just played keyboards on it, came up with some stuff, and he said, "Oh, you wrote that? There you go."
Yeah.
You know, okay, thanks. The lyrics and melody, that's all him.
Yeah.
So.
Nice. When Dr. Think wasn't touring, what did a day in the life look like for you?
I was just chillaxing a lot.
Yeah.
When I was off, like if we weren't touring, granted, I had some other musicians I worked with to write with, you know, and we were writing some stuff together and trying to shop songs to other artists. We were trying to get publishing stuff going, and we had some pretty good nibbles on a few songs. There was one song I did with a gentleman that A&M Records wanted, and they offered us some front money, blah blah blah, but we didn't take the deal. In hindsight, I wish we had.
Yeah.
For whatever reason, they wanted me and that other partner to possibly do a full-on publishing thing, deal where we'd have to write 50 songs a year, 40 to 50 songs. And I was still touring, and my friend was still touring with another big name artist at the time. And we just didn't have the time to devote to being 50 songs a year because of the people we were working with. But that would be, typically if we weren't rehearsing or touring, which didn't last very long, we get little breaks, here and there. I would play golf. I forgot to mention that was one of my hobbies growing up.
Oh, yeah. Yep.
I played golf. I got it. I remember one summer when we were completely off from touring, I got out and played twice a week, which I never used to do.
Hmm.
And I was playing regularly, and I managed to get really good at golf for a minute. But that's about it.
Yeah.
I'm not very good now. I think I played once last summer. That was it. Or at the end of the fall. I during COVID, when they opened things up a little more, I played one time. That was it. But it was nice to be outside and hanging out.
Yeah.
But yeah, my typical day would be playing, in the studio, or I had a little home set up, of course, in those days. And try to write something, come up with some stuff, or just relax.
After leaving the Revolution, what was your next step, and where did you go next?
Actually would have been the MPG.
Yep.
Which was at the end of 1990. That's when I went to work for a locally based record label.
Yep.
Which was all based in Canada too. They had offices here in Canada, which was KTEL Records. So I worked with them for a solid 5 years doing production work for them.
Yeah.
Some of their special records. I did a lot of really odd projects for them. So,
yeah.
All that. And some of that you can actually hear on Spotify now. If you just plug in Dr. Fink, it'll take you to some of that work.
Yeah, I saw that you had an album out as well. What was it called? Ultrasound? Yeah.
I'm thinking about doing some new material now.
Oh, yeah.
It's all real. Yeah, after many, many years of not doing that.
But yep.
I just wanted to be more of a producer engineer, over the years since leaving Prince. Because, I was raising kids.
Yeah.
I didn't really want to be touring much at all. Once my kids were more grown up, that's when I got back out playing a lot live again.
Yeah.
Quite a bit. So I've been doing that for about the last 11 years, doing some live stuff.
Cool.
Including reuniting with the Revolution 3 years ago.
On April 21st, 2016, Prince was tragically found dead at his home in Paisley Park. Where were you when you heard the news, and what kind of an impact did it have on you?
Well, that year, January 1st of 2016, was when I started working for another company here called ADX Labs. And ADX Labs is the parent company of our current company called V Media Entertainment, which is has a record label, music streaming service, and a video service on there going. And it's starting to do some interesting things right now. Prior to that, I was in my office that year. I had come on board in January 1st of 2016. So by April, I'd only been in there for a little over 4.5 months.
Yeah.
Working, and I was actually in my office when I saw a news flash come onto my phone about this person being found deceased at Paisley Park, and I thought, oh no.
Yeah.
And they didn't announce it was Prince yet because they didn't know who it was.
Yeah.
And I just immediately, my heart sank. And I said, oh my gosh, it better not be him, because I know he's one of the only people that lives there.
Yeah.
And maybe he had an assistant and maybe one other staff member. He didn't have a lot of people over there at that time.
Mm.
So I was like, hoping it wasn't him.
Yeah.
But then about a half hour later, I get a call from another friend of mine who is really good friends with the head of the police department over there, and where Prince's building was, Chanhassen, Minnesota. He said, I have got inside information that it was Prince.
Mm.
And oh my God.
Yeah.
And the issue is that the media had not been told yet, but I knew.
Yeah.
The head of that. So I immediately was just went into deep shock. You know, it was like one of those things where the whole, everything goes away and you're in a surreal state of mind. You know, it's like having a family member die.
Yeah.
And, it was really, really difficult. And the rest of that day, and then I went out to lunch with a couple of my coworkers, and it came across the news that he was gone. So I just sat, I couldn't eat, you know, I just sat with him and talked because I was so beside myself about it.
Yeah.
So that's all I can say. It was just
massive loss.
Very massive loss.
What's life for Dr. Think look like today, and what are your plans for the future?
Well, like as I just mentioned, I've been working for this multimedia company called B Media Entertainment.
Yep.
And have a record label called B Records, and a music streaming service called My Music.
Yep.
Which caters to independent hip hop and R&B artists.
Nice.
And we have 6 signed artists on the label now.
Yep.
One of which is my son, Max.
Awesome. Max Fink,
who goes by the name of Max Millie, which is spelled MVXMILLI. You can catch him on Spotify and elsewhere on all streaming platforms. And then there's several other artists, a young man by the name of Nico Brim, who is also the son of our CEO, Jojo Brim. And then we have MJ Songstress, Kev Rogers, Lil Crush. Is that everybody? Oh, and Julian King. We have a new ad recently, a young man, excellent, excellent artist. So yeah, we have some great artists on the label, and I'm in the director of the catalog and licensing side of things. So what I do is I seek placements for our artists' music, amongst others, because we have a full management wing. I forgot to mention that we have managers in our company that manage our artists and some other outside artists that are not associated with the label. And we also have a music promotional service called All Music Promo and a playlisting service called Just Added Music.
Awesome. Sounds good.
So if artists are interested in our services, just, you know, tell them to go to vmedia.com. That's our website.
Yep.
And all our information is there.
Nice.
Our company also, not our media company, but the parent company, ADX, has a company called GameSmart.
Yep.
And Pixel Inc., which is a video game design company. And
cool.
I had the opportunity to executive produce a new game called Rhythm Rumble that'll be out late this year, which features 13 new songs, all from all genres of music. And I either performed on, co-wrote, or just, you know, produced the whole soundtrack, and had 8 other composers collaborate on the project. Yeah, Nintendo Switch.
Nice. Matt Fink, thank you so much for joining us today and sharing your story. It's been an honor and a privilege to speak to you. And yeah, all the best for the future.
All right, well, it's good talking to you, Adam. Take care. Have a good one.
Well, there you have it. That concludes my interview with Dr. Fink. I hope you all enjoyed that interview. Feel free to share the episode around and tell your friends and family about it. You can follow the podcast on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and TikTok for podcast announcements, updates, and more, or head to our website at lyricsoftheirlife.com. Make sure you subscribe on Spotify or iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you enjoy the podcast, please leave us a positive 5-star review on iTunes. It would be greatly appreciated, and it only takes a minute or two, and helps the podcast rank up and be seen so it continues to grow, and I can continue bringing you more episodes such as this one. If you would like to take that support a step further, Lyrics of Their Life also has a Patreon page where you can pledge your support for as little as $1 a month, with no lock-in contract, just a little something to show your support and appreciation for the podcast. Thank you everyone for tuning in. I'm your host Adam Hampton, and this is Lyrics of Their Life.